Welcome to Historias, the podcast for the Southeastern Council of Latin American Studies. I'm your host today, Lily Balafe, and I'm today talking with Marian Schlatterbeck. She's an associate professor of history at the University of California, Davis. In May 2018, Marian published her first book titled Beyond the Vanguard, Everyday Revolutionaries in Allende's Chile with the University of California Press. As a historian, Marian explores popular politics in Chile in the decade before Augusto Pinochet's dictatorship, and she provides us an account of how working class people transformed the existing social order by embracing radical politics. In her work, she charts how, through their daily life, as students, as workers, as shantytown residents, Chileans forge new understandings of the meaning of revolutionary change. Marian, welcome to Historias.
Thank you, Lily.
So we're here to learn about your work that you do, thinking about the Allende era, but we also really have to talk about what's going on right now in Chile. I think really should just start with what everyone is calling the Estallido Social of 2019, these landmark happenings in Chile over the past few weeks. And I want to, before we get started, just pause briefly to acknowledge that we're recording this episode on Friday, November 15th. There is late breaking news as of this morning about an agreement reached that will move Chile towards a vote on the creation of a new constitution. And so we'll touch on that in our conversation today, but who knows how things are going to unfold in the days between our recording and when this episode goes live. So we may have to do a follow-up episode before we've even gotten off the ground. But with that, Marian, can you talk to us a little bit about how the Estallido Social began? We're both historians. I know we could probably spend hours unpacking the historical context that helps us to understand these events, but sort of most immediately, can you talk to us a little bit about the precipitating events over the last several weeks? For a lot of our listeners tuning in, they might have the idea already that this started with a public transportation fare hike and things just seemed to take off from there. Can you talk to a little bit about just the mechanics of what unfolded over the last several weeks?
Of course. So a little less than a month ago, the government announced, as you mentioned, fare increases of 30 pesos on the Santiago subway system. And high school students devised a strategy of civil disobedience, calling on the massive evasion of paying the fare. This is the jumping of turnstiles. And the government of conservative businessman Sebastián Piñera really mismanaged the protests from the very start. I think in a lot of ways, had their initial response been different, we never would have arrived at this moment. But we really are at a really transformative moment in Chile's history today. And we'll touch on sort of the latest developments in just a moment. So the government initially denounced the students as delinquents, kind of called for those evading the metro fare to face the steepest criminal sanctions. And this was at a time when there were so many different famous cases of corruption, of those with power and influence in Chile avoiding taxes and, you know, getting a slap on the wrist effectively. And so there's a lot of discontent that, you know, there really are kind of two different laws or two different systems that seem to apply to people really unequally. Right? How could a small fare evasion be punished with several months in prison and massive tax evasions get sentenced with an ethics class? And, and so from there, you know, even the kind of criticisms of the attempt to dismiss the students as saying, you know, you have a school pass and a reduced fare already, so why are you protesting? And the students quite wisely came back and said, this isn't for us. This is for our grandparents who can't afford to retire and for our parents who worry about how they're going to pay the bills at the end of every month. And so really quickly, I think the students generated a broader public sympathy of people saying, why one more increase in the cost of living? It's worth pointing out that, you know, among OECD countries, Chile has the highest rate of inequality. Minimum wage in Chile is, the median income is around $500 or less in Chile. And, you know, about a fourth of people's income were actually spent on transportation, not to mention increase in electricity, which are privately owned companies, increase in private healthcare systems, a privatized pension system that leaves retirees around $200 a month. And again, Chile has the highest cost of living, or one of the highest costs of living in Latin America. And so the fare protests, in some ways, none of us saw this coming 2 or 3 months ago, but the deep inequalities that are entrenched in Chilean society, as well as a fairly widespread discontent with the political and economic model, is not a surprise. That's been really kind of brewing, or has really been present since the transition to democracy in 1990. And I think that's why quickly one of the main sort of slogans of this estallido social became, it's not about 30 pesos, it's about 30 years.
And so some of what you're talking about is already helping to make sense for me, and perhaps for our listeners as well, of some of the signs that we're seeing just in the kind of visual culture of these protests that have been unfolding. I remember I saw a sign of an older fellow carrying a sign that said, "I'm not afraid of death, but I am afraid of retirement."
Yes. I mean, I think, again, the form of neoliberal economics that was implemented in Chile under the dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet really wasn't possible without that level of authoritarian repression. And I think so many of the sort of economic innovations or the miracles, or even quite recently, Sebastián Piñera called Chile a democratic oasis in Latin America, really ring false for many people, right? And I think, you know, all of these mechanisms from school vouchers, which are, you know, very ubiquitous in Chile and are sort of trotted out periodically in American politics as a model, or privatized social security, you know, Chileans really have decades of experience with these economic systems, and they can say quite clearly they don't work, and they don't work for the majority of people.
One thing that I would love to hear about a little bit from you is that the conversations that have been unfolding about these economic systems and their failure, about the inequity and how justice is doled out or not doled out, are not just happening via the places that we can easily access and see as outside international observers by looking at footage of protests or by cruising through social media. But there's also these very local, sort of intimate, on a micro neighborhood scale, gatherings of folks that have been taking place across the country, these local cabildos, I believe they've been called. Could you talk to us a little bit about those gatherings that have been happening?
Of course. I mean, I think, you know, part of, as these protests spread outside Santiago and really reached sort of massive scale, right? People talk about the 1.2 million person march in downtown Santiago. They spread across all the regions of Chile, even the smallest towns. So these are sort of people marching in the streets on an unprecedented scale, and also incredibly distressing levels of violence in response from the government through the Carabineros, the national police, and the Chilean military, which were called out onto the streets when Sebastián Piñera declared a state of siege in response to the protests. And this was the first time that kind of emergency declaration to restore public order had been called in response to social protests. Right? There have been declarations of states of emergency in the context of several earthquakes in Chile, but never in response to protesters. So that's sort of what we were seeing from the outside, tracking this on social media. As you mentioned, I think, you know, one of the most incredible dynamics that's really emerged is this effort to sort of reoccupy public space, reclaim a sort of social commons, and also to sort of reconnect with other people around you. And so these town halls or cabildos are happening across Chile. They're happening in public parks. They're happening in courtyards of large apartment complexes. They're happening in schools. Sometimes they're convened by neighbors. Sometimes there are other ones that are called quite specifically kind of by profession or around LGBT issues or feminist issues. Everybody's convening these different grassroots assemblies. And they're there to debate, what is it that we want for Chile? And I think, you know, by and large, it seems like one of the kind of consistent debates by one of the social organizations that's sort of tabulating some of the proposals that come out of these cabildos is for an asamblea constituyente, a constitutional assembly. But I think what's so important about this kind of decentralized grassroots political organizing is that it's really an example of how politics are reconstituted from the grassroots. And I think so much of what Chile is grappling with today is the legacy of the 1980 Constitution that was drafted behind closed doors by advisors close to Augusto Pinochet, that was implemented undemocratically, and that is still a constitution on the books. There have been modifications, but the form of politics that it created, that it promoted this politics in which it was impossible to make any major transformations to the economic and political model that the dictatorship put into place. And that's why ultimately, in some ways, Pinochet stepped down from power after the 1988 plebiscite, because the Chile he'd created was so firmly institutionalized. It took supermajorities to change any part of it. And so the result in a lot of ways is the last 30 years of the Concertación, the center-left governing coalitions, really could only make these kind of small modifications. Politicians stopped kind of thinking big about what could be changed. It was just about tweaks or perfecting the system. When you talk about perfeccionamiento, you're not talking about transformation. You're talking about making better what's already there. And what was already there for most Chileans, as they've resoundingly said in the last few weeks and in the last few decades, was not working.
And I'm curious about the spaces that these conversations are happening. It reminds me actually some of the grassroots organizing and spaces of sociability where different groups who are organizing amongst themselves during the era that you write about in your research. It sort of reminds me of today, and I want to get to that in a moment. But I'm wondering about something that you said actually when you came to visit my students the other day, where these cabildos that citizens are creating are making spaces for them to come and talk to people in their immediate community about these issues, and opening lines of communication that are really powerful and can be really transformative to people's experiences of this moment and of imaginings of different futures.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, maybe in some ways it seems so simple or so small, but in the sort of moment of late stage capitalism in which we all live, in which we're constantly crunched for time, in which we're constantly feeling squeezed to have the sort of labors of the economy take up all our time, and that, you know, many people have written about the sort of privatization of care, it is a kind of radical act to turn to a neighbor and say, "I see you and I hear you," right? This sort of sense of finding each other in these public places. And I think more importantly, it's also about processing an experience as it's happening. And so I think you're right. There are elements in these cabildos that are similar to some of the work that I write about, sort of grassroots social movements in the 60s and 19 in Chile, as well as ideas about popular power and debating sort of people's sovereignty, that a lot of these conversations have to depart from what are people's needs? What is it? Ask people what it is that they want, because that's the way in which you validate their voice as part of a broader democratic process, as part of building a movement that's coalitional, because it brings different sectors together. And I think there's a second element of these cabildos, particularly for the generation that lived through the dictatorship, that has echoes of Christian-based communities in shanty towns. Historian Alison Brewery has written a fantastic book that looks at these experiences. The importance of creating spaces, and in this case, during the dictatorship, it was often under the auspices of the Catholic Church and progressive priests, create spaces in which people can process and reflect on what's happening. And that's also a form of care that I think should not be overlooked.
And it's really interesting, because we see at this moment that in these conversations, what is coming out as one of the key demands or bullet points from the conclusions of these cabildos in several different sites across the country is this push towards the need for a new constitution. And so it's this interesting moment with this late breaking news this morning in which we see the kind of from the ground up and from top down. I'm not going to say meeting in the middle, that's too optimistic, but we see like this convergence of conversations about the same thing that as of this morning is starting to be from a top down as well as a bottom up kind of conversation and organizing. Could you talk to us a little bit about the late breaking news from this morning?
And I think, you know, it goes without saying, we have to acknowledge we wouldn't be here today talking about the real possibility to draft democratically a new constitution for Chile were it not for the incredible levels of mobilization and sustained social protests that ordinary Chileans have carried out by showing up day after day for nearly a month to express their discontent with the status quo. And I think it's also important to acknowledge that hasn't happened without cost. Right? There's been 20 people who were killed during the protests. Over 5,000 have been detained by state agents. Increasingly disturbing reports coming out about different forms of abuse that detainees have suffered, again, at the hands of the police. And, you know, one of the forms of repression that has perhaps received the most attention inside and outside of Chile has been police intentionally firing birdshot or rubber bullets at protesters' eyes. One young man has been left completely blinded, but there's over 100 other individuals who have been hospitalized and are undergoing treatment to try to recover their vision. So I think...
Yeah, I saw that there was a statistic that Chile has hit the highest case number of ocular injuries of any other country in the world.
You can't have that high level without it being an intentional practice. That's not a stray bullets. And so I think, you know, again, as Chile goes forward, there are incredibly important questions about accountability. Will police or military face charges for the violence that have been done? Will there be credible investigations into the suspicious deaths in some of these incidences of fires being set and bodies subsequently being recovered? So that is an area in which I think, you know, sustained pressure needs to continue, but also for the sort of credibility of Chile's justice system, there needs to be, whether it's international investigations, but the Chilean state has to answer for that violence because Sebastián Piñera called the troops out into the streets.
Yes, and we've been seeing the photographs coming in from colleagues of ours posting pictures of you know, them looking outside their living room window and there's a line of tanks going down the street in a residential neighborhood. And it's striking to me thinking about what that must be like for people of various different generations in Chile, those who remember state of siege, you know, curfew era during the dictatorship, and for those whom that is something that they know about, thinking about younger generations where that is part of their past, but all of a sudden this is actually happening in front of them. And I think that it's a moment in which it can't help but put conversations about Chile's past front and center and intertwined with thinking about what's happening now. So if it's all right with you, I'd like to segue to thinking a little bit about the past and through some of the work that you have done. You have worked on thinking about all these different kinds of groups and mobilizations and the way that they intersected, be they student movement, and be they shantytown dwellers, or folks working within the context of, as you mentioned before, liberation theology frameworks. I'm wondering if you could talk to us about one of the key ideas from your work, which is during that pre-Allende and Allende era, this idea of everyday revolutions or everyday revolutionaries. Would you maybe give us a little bit of insight onto what it is that you wrote about in that vein? Because I think it's really relevant to what's going on now.
I came to this idea of thinking about everyday revolutions because it struck me really in the kind of history of Latin America. When we think about social revolutions, and I know both you and I teach the sort of 20th century Latin American social revolutions courses at UC Davis and UC Santa Cruz. It's always about these epic moments, right? The sort of taking of state power, the sort of protagonism often of these sort of male political leaders. And I wanted to think about, was there a way to kind of unsettle this assumption that only kind of big R revolutions matter? What are some of the sort of smaller, more quotidian, seemingly really mundane ways in which ordinary people come to challenge the status quo? And I think really what defined Chile in the 1960s, and this importantly preceded Allende's election in 1970, in a lot of ways, the sort of tremendous mobilization of Chilean society made possible his victory. In the 1960s, you know, again, that sort of period, whether you want to date it from the agrarian reform and the election of Eduardo Frei in 1964, really was, I think, the high point of democratization of Chilean society, of people feeling like they had a stake in the system, feeling like their demands were heard, and feeling like they had a way to carry out change. And so, you know, one of the chapters that I had a chance to discuss with your students looked at tomas de terreno, the sort of urban land occupations, as one way in which the shantytown, the pobladores movement, people had an ability to carry out change on their own, independent of the state. And I think, you know, really what's on the table today in 2019 in Chile is really this unfinished task about how to democratize society, not just sort of democracy in terms of electoral politics, but how do you democratize participation in making those decisions from the citizenry? How do you create a system or create mechanisms in which people feel like their voices are heard? And that, again, is why I think, you know, the news that broke at 2:30 a.m. today that politicians across the political spectrum have reached an agreement by which there's going to be a national plebiscite in Chile this coming April, in which people will have, again, a democratic process through which Chileans can vote, yes, we want a new constitution, no, we don't, and then if we are going for a new constitution, what should be the mechanism, what should be the body that is convened to write it? And this is, again, where there's sort of the next level step is the debate is, should it be, or the offer, it should be a mixed constitutional convention, which would be half composed of members of Congress and half elected delegates, or should it be a sort of fully open, newly elected body for the constitutional convention? It's interesting, a small aside, that the politicians chose convention instead of assembly, because all of the demands coming from the grassroots is to call this una asamblea constituyente, a constitutional assembly. But again, then from there in October 2020, they've already set the timeline for this would be the moment in which that constitutional body would be elected. I think, again, thinking about process, there's still obviously a lot to be worked out in terms of the specifics. But, you know, this is a moment in which really Chileans have the possibility for the first time to draft a constitution through a democratic process. That's never happened before in Chile's history. And so that's, again, why I think these experiences at the grassroots, these small neighborhood assemblies, the cabildos, really matter for this process of recreating politics from the bases.
And there's all kinds of different voices that have opinions and thoughts about how they should be able to be involved in this process. And I would, if I can, I would like to direct our conversations to thinking about young people and their voices. I mean, as you described earlier on in our interview, the initial protests about turnstile jumping after fare hikes were young people. They were high school age students. Am I right?
Absolutely. And again, I think we have to ask ourselves sort of two questions, kind of why young people, right? Why in this moment? And we have to acknowledge this isn't the first time in Chile's history or in other countries' recent history that young people have been at the forefront of pushing forward we're putting on a kind of national agenda demands for kind of new social contracts. And I think, you know, much has been made of calling this the kind of generation without fear. And by that, I mean sort of people in Chile born after the 1990 transition to democracy. You know, I think it's worth pointing out that there's multiple generations that were now essentially raised during the post-dictatorship era, right? And so, you know, 2006, the Revolución Pingüina, the sort of one of the largest student mobilizations. You know, a lot of the people who were college students in 2006, and I was actually an exchange student at the Universidad de Concepción that year, you know, a lot of us are kind of mid-career professionals in our 30s, right? Like we for Chileans who are part of that student movement, you know, there's real frustration. They sat down to negotiate with the government of Michelle Bachelet and really nothing changed. And so then again, after the election of Sebastián Piñera for his first term in 2010, we had the Chilean winter, the massive student movement of 2011. And a lot of those young people, you know, are now educators, are now young professionals. One young man, again, now in his late 20s, who I interviewed as a student leader in 2012, is now a local middle school social studies teacher. And he's, you know, done incredible work with his students and also in kind of convening in these public spaces, you know, popular history classes about the constitutional process in Chile. And so I think you have an accumulation of experiences, not just of being part of these protest movements, but I think more importantly, one thing that was notable in that sort of 2011 student movement, and again, there's sort of certain parallels to the Occupy Wall Street movement in the United States, was this creation of assemblies, was the horizontality of how politics were practiced, of people saying, you know, I gained the confidence to state my opinion, to make my opinion heard before others. And so these are accumulating experiences, right? I don't think the sort of young people today were unaware of these past experiences, as well as the ways in which previous Chilean administrations had really failed to produce any significant reforms in response. I also think that there's something to be said, you know, not just for sort of seeing this as a generation without fear, without the sort of baggage of having lived through the darkest days of repression of the Pinochet era. And there's also, I think, you know, too often, many of us don't take seriously young people as historical actors. I think in so many ways, young people have more freedom, more creativity to imagine alternatives, right? Because kind of once, you know, we're all launched into our careers or we're concerned with paying bills, with building a career, with raising a family, there's suddenly less time for sort of free thinking about how could we imagine something outside of the status quo? And so I think,
yeah, I mean, your possibility scapes somehow become bounded by the things, the structures that you've already built. Whereas if there's perhaps less of a boundedness is kind of along the lines of what you're thinking for young people.
Exactly. And I think, you know, again, one of speaking to this issue of the democratization of Chilean society, you know, one of the sort of interesting proposals that I just saw was a call to extend suffrage in Chile to 14 and above. Currently it's 18 and above. And so again, the question of if it's young people who really made this moment possible, shouldn't they also have a say in the process? And again, it's a say in voting of saying what kind of a constitution, do they want a constitution? What kind of constitutional body should draft it? And who should be elected to represent them on that body, right? We're not sort of saying lower the age for the presidency to 15. We're saying like, let young people have a real stake in the political process that's unfolding to transform their country.
Yeah, I hear you. I agree. I want to start to wrap up here, but I want to kind of close out with one of the questions that one of my students brought to you after you visited my class the other week. That she said, I'm an organizer here on campus. And what is your advice to me? And you know, coming out of your experience as a researcher, as an expert on Chile. And one of the things you talked to her about was listening to people and meeting them where they're at in terms of what their needs are, what it is there, what it is that would make their lives better. And I imagine that you must be getting questions from your students about what's going on here, but also in these moments of just, you know, uncertainty about where all of this is leading. What is your advice for anyone who's listening who might be a student, a historias listener who's a young person themselves? Like, what would you say to them in this moment as we're looking at this kind of blasted open horizon that we are not sure how it's going to end up, and they're thinking about their own possibility scapes and their future, and maybe they're an organizer or thinking about it. Like, what's some advice for them?
I think the two pieces of advice that I have is to be attentive to your present. Right? I mean, I think whether it's, you know, my students and I have been kind of tracking the unfolding events in Chile, but I think it's so easy sometimes to, you know, again, we're sort of constantly inundated with information to sort of just tune out. But I think really paying attention to what's happening around the world and in our own country matters. And it matters for the second point to be able to think through how change happens and whether or not we want to be a part of that change. And so I think, you know, for all my students who are involved in different student organizations or movements, and I know many of our students were mobilized this week for the Supreme Court DACA hearings, I think it's important to validate the process of organizing. It's not glamorous. It's that kind of trabajo de hormiga, the ant work of showing up each and every day for what you believe in. And sometimes change doesn't happen as quickly or as spectacularly as it has in Chile in the last month, but it does happen. It's a slow, long process. And I think showing up for what you believe in and not feeling confined by the existing options that are around you. And I think, you know, I'm grateful every day to wake up and work with young people because I think it inspires me in so many different ways to really see how quickly the political conversations have changed in our own country.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you so much, Marianne, for joining us here on Historias. Again, I'm Lily Balafe, and I've been speaking today with Marianne Schlatterbeck. And maybe we'll have to have you back on as we continue to watch this unfolding horizon. So thank you again for joining us.
Thanks, Lily.
Hasta la próxima.